Now, we're going to take a look now, as I said, at ghosts of elections past. One of the reasons why we are going back so frequently during the course of our discussions and our archive shows to one or another aspect of one or another of this country's major political assassinations or attempted assassinations is that really one can only understand the present in terms of the past. Recently, for example, in examining the factors I believed to be behind the selection of Lloyd Benson to be Michael Dukakis' running mate, I took a look at the death and, I believe, assassination by cancer of Willie Velazquez, a very, very significant, though not particularly well-known outside of Latino circles, Latino voter registration activist who had been responsible for the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project, which had been responsible for increasing the number of elected Latino officials by roughly 82%, and the percentage of registered Latino voters by roughly 40%, this in just 6 years. Velazquez was going to work, or had been going to work, for the Dukakis campaign, and in that respect was regarded as a key element of Dukakis' Southwest strategy. The death of Willie Velazquez left a big hole in the Dukakis operation in the mind of many of his strategists. That appears to have been one of the elements which mandated the selection of Lloyd Benson as his running mate. And as I say, I feel that the death of Willie Velazquez was an assassination. As I said, and as we have talked about so often, it is a matter of public record, this from Freedom of Information Act documents which have been obtained by researchers, that the CIA and other elements of the national security establishment had a means of giving people cancer as early as 1954. It's a safe bet that with the advances in medical technology since then, those means are probably not only still existent, but in fact, somewhat or considerably more sophisticated than they were 35 or 34 years ago. We're going to take a look tonight at the 1972 election and specifically the removal from that campaign of George Wallace by gunfire. Reading from an interesting column in the New York Times of Monday, July 25th of 1988, this is Dateline Dan T. Carter, or it's by Dan T. Carter, Headler Dateline Atlanta headline, "The Nixon Cover-Up Goes On." 14 years after he resigned in disgrace from the presidency, Richard Nixon has emerged as a senior statesman and American oracle on important foreign policy issues. While the American disease of historical amnesia figures prominently in this remarkable rehabilitation, we should not slight Richard Nixon's own resourcefulness. For nearly a decade and a half, the former president has orchestrated a brilliant campaign of time-consuming lawsuits and hard-nosed political lobbying to delay the release of important historical records from his administration. In short, the cover-up goes on. Just over a month ago, for example, I checked into the Nixon Presidential Papers Project, unquote, outside Washington, to continue my work on a biography of the former Alabama governor, George Wallace. I had scarcely unpacked my word processor in the Spartan, warehouse-like facilities before a veteran researcher sidled over to my desk, glanced around, and quietly offered me some advice. "Don't ever get excited about important materials you find in these papers," he said. "If you do, for heaven's sake, don't say anything. One of the Nixon people often works in the research room." With a conspiratorial nod, he moved back to his desk. Over the next few days, I found that I was unconsciously shielding the screen of my word processor and looking over each new arrival with a suspicious eye. I never did identify the Nixon mole. He or she may not even exist. What seems clear is that dealings with the writings of paranoiac breeds paranoia, or of paranoiacs breeds paranoia. Let me read that sentence again. Over the next few days, I found that I was unconsciously shielding the screen of my word processor and looking over each new arrival with a suspicious eye. I never did identify the Nixon mole. He or she may not even exist. What seems clear is that dealing with the writings of paranoiacs breeds paranoia. The issue dates back to the weeks after Mr. Nixon quit the White House, when his lawyers made it clear that the former president reserved the right to withhold and even destroy materials. Skipping down in the column, in my research, I hope to learn details of the covert Nixon operations directed against George Wallace between 1969 and 1971. Mr. Wallace gave Mr. Nixon a nasty turn in the 1968 presidential election, when the Alabama governor's third-party candidacy siphoned voters away from Mr. Nixon and came close to forcing the election into the House of Representatives. Beginning in early 1970, Mr. Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, with Mr. Nixon's approval, authorized $400,000 in secret cash payments to strengthen Mr. Wallace's main Democratic primary opponent in that year's Alabama gubernatorial race. When Mr. Wallace narrowly won re-election, Mr. Haldeman promoted a federal tax probe of Mr. Wallace, his brother Gerald, and a number of their friends, and then leaked the preliminary results to the columnist Jack Anderson. Sometime in 1971, the Nixon strategy took a different turn. Under circumstances that remain shrouded in secrecy, the Justice Department ended its investigation of Mr. Wallace and his brother. Within months, the governor shelved his third-party plans and entered the Democratic primaries. In the bitter campaign that followed, Mr. Wallace poured gasoline on the Democrats' self-immolating bonfire, while Mr. Haldeman monitored the Wallace candidacy through high-level contacts. It's an intriguing series of events, but I was unable to document all the details because Mr. Nixon's representatives have blocked almost all of the Wallace documents in Mr. Haldeman's 1972 presidential campaign files. In fact, Mr. Nixon's representatives have successfully prevented the release of more than 40 boxes of Haldeman memos, notes, and communications on the election of 1972. Well, we're going to take a look now at some of the circumstances surrounding the shooting of George Wallace in May of 1972 that removed George Wallace not only as a Democratic primary campaign contender, but also as a possible third-party candidate in November. And again, one of the reasons why it's important to study this country's political assassinations is to familiarize oneself with the fact and the ongoing situation, which is that America is plagued by political assassination as a matter of course. Political assassination has become an established way of life in the United States, and it's against this background of institutionalized political murder that deaths of people like Willie Velasquez, in my opinion, have to be examined. We've taken a look at the shooting of President Reagan just a few weeks ago. We touched briefly on the shooting of Allard Lowenstein, the assassination of Allard Lowenstein in 1980. Again, by way of understanding the legacy of the bullet as it affects the ballot, we're now going to take a look at some of the curious circumstances surrounding the shooting of George Wallace and its effect on the 1972 presidential election.
We're going to read a long segment, actually an entire section, from the book Government by Gunplay, subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. It's edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazigian, and it was copyright in paperback 1976 by Signet Books.
Forward by Philip Agee, incidentally.
That's right. And we're going to read the section entitled The Shooting of George Wallace. This whole section is written by William W. Turner, whose work is very familiar to One Step Beyond listeners. He was one of the co-writers of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, wrote a book called Power on the Right, and several others that we have quoted from extensively. Himself a former FBI man, as I believe is probably mentioned in here somewhere. And anyway, we're going to read from The Shooting of George Wallace by William W. Turner. The 1972 presidential election was basically decided on May 15, 1972, in a shopping center in Laurel, Maryland. It was there that Arthur Bremer shot George Wallace. If Wallace had stayed in the race, he would have drawn a significant number of votes away from Richard Nixon. At the time of the Wallace shooting, Nixon was not as secure in his prospects as he would be later in the year, after his trip to Moscow. Just a week before the incident in Laurel, Nixon had ordered the blockade of Haiphong Harbor and the bombing of Hanoi. The outcome of this action was not yet apparent. But when Nixon was greeted in the Soviet Union, he was able once again to present himself to Americans as a peace candidate while pursuing a war policy. The elimination of the right-wing Wallace and the manipulation of images, undercutting the anti-war candidacy of George McGovern, enabled Richard Nixon to win decisively. Arthur Bremer, the would-be assassin of George Wallace, appeared to be yet another psychotic lone gunman. The independent investigation of former FBI agent William W. Turner, author of Hoover's FBI and Power on the Right, however, has uncovered new evidence about discrepancies in Bremer's finances, his involvement with the, quote, Jesus people, and his activity on the 1972 Wisconsin primary day that cast doubt on the official theory. Turner was commissioned in his work by Joe Pomerantz and Miles Pennybacker of Connecticut. Scarcely a month before the Watergate break-in, Alabama Governor George C. Wallace was removed from the presidential race by a nondescript gunman named Arthur H. Bremer. And scarcely an hour after the shooting on May 15, 1972, in a Laurel, Maryland shopping plaza, White House counsel Charles Colson reportedly was instructing superannuated CIA agent E. Howard Hunt, then with the Nixon Re-Election Committee, to fly immediately to Milwaukee and plant material in Bremer's apartment that would link him with the left. Hunt told the Washington Post that Colson wanted him to, quote, see if there is left or radical reading material around, unquote. Hunt balked on the grounds that the FBI would already have sealed off the apartment. In fact, the FBI came and went before finally securing the premises hours later, after curiosity seekers and the press had rummaged through it. In a subsequent Washington Post interview, Colson at first tried to squelch the story, then altered it by saying that when President Nixon heard of the shooting, he became quite agitated and, quote, voiced immediate concern that the assassin might have ties to the Republican Party, or even worse, the President's Re-Election Committee, unquote. Thus, it remains uncertain whether Hunt's unfulfilled mission to Milwaukee was intended to plant material incriminating to the left, scoop up material incriminating to Creep, or both. Creep, by the way, is the committee to re-elect the president, for those of you on whose brains that acronym has not been burned forever. It is perfectly clear, however, that the Nixon forces stood to gain the most by the elimination of Wallace from the 1972 election campaign.
Continuing with this section of the book, with this particular essay, Wallace appealed to a conservative bloc that otherwise would have voted for Nixon. How seriously the Nixon camp took this threat from the right is illustrated by the fact that in 1970, when Wallace was embroiled in a hotly contested gubernatorial race in Alabama, Nixon attorney Herbert Kalmbach secretly channeled $400,000 to Wallace's opponent, Albert Brewer, who lost by an eyelash. As the presidential campaign began, the early polls show Democratic frontrunner Edmund Muskie edging the president in a one-on-one battle. At the time of the Wallace shooting, the Harris poll demonstrated that Nixon's margins over George McGovern and Hubert Humphrey were precariously reduced when Wallace appeared in the picture as an independent. But when a grinning Arthur Bremer pumped four shots into Wallace, Nixon's victory was virtually assured. Bullets, instead of ballots, had once again dictated who would be president. Had the White House plumbers or some other component of the Nixon machine pulled off the surpassing dirty trick by manipulating Bremer? It was the reasonable question any detective would ask after a crime, since a clear-cut motive was present. As Watergate unfolded, the near paranoia gripping the Nixon strategists and their resort to dirty tricks overkill was graphically revealed. No sooner had I begun work in Milwaukee than Governor Wallace suddenly announced his disbelief that Bremer acted alone. "You think one fellow can follow you around all over the country, hardly never made $30 a week in his life?" he rhetorically asked a New York Times reporter. "How can he buy an automobile, buy two guns, stay at the Waldorf Astoria, go to massage parlors, rent limousines, go to Canada, went all over Michigan, followed me around?" Wallace was also skeptical of Bremer's diary found in his car after the shooting, pointing out that Bremer had never written one before. "The diary was written for him and he copied it," the governor speculated. Had the governor hit the target when he brought up Bremer's finances, diary, and status as a loner, quote unquote? There was also a problem about Bremer's political convictions, if any. My investigation sought to find answers to these questions.
Continuing. The Alabama... There we go. Arthur Herman Bremer was born August 21st, 1950.
Can
we skip one?
We must skip one here. Let's see. Down to here?
Yeah.
No, we begin here. We skip this section here. That's it. That's the
right.
Beginning.
Arthur Herman Bremer is not where we start. Okay, the Alabaman announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination on January 13th, and Bremer spent $80 for a Charter Arms 38 caliber revolver the same day. This weapon evidently was to replace a similar one seized by police in the Silk Stocking suburb of Fox Point, Wisconsin, on the evening of November 18, 1971. The incident remains a puzzle. Bremer was checked out because he was stopped in a no-parking zone in front of a Jewish synagogue, Congregation Shalom. Noticing a box of shells on the front seat, the policeman searched Bremer's person and found a loaded .38. Why Bremer was outside the temple, on the opposite side of Milwaukee from his usual haunts, has never been explained. The police told me they thought he was, quote, dingy, although one sergeant ventured that Bremer was highly susceptible to suggestion. Quote, if a Nazi got a hold of him and told him to do something, the sergeant said, he'd do it.
A very prescient comment under the circumstances, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. On March 1st, 1972, an organizational meeting for George Wallace was held at the Pfister Hotel, and Bremer attended. Glenn A. Victorine, a fellow worker with Bremer at the Milwaukee Athletic Club, Bremer left his busboy job on February 15th, was surprised to see him there because he had seemingly been disinterested in politics. A Wallace campaign aide from Alabama, Gray Hodges, was quoted in the press as saying that Bremer assisted in the Wisconsin primary by handing out literature. The young man cadged money and food from him, Hodges said, and on several occasions slept in the literature storeroom at campaign headquarters. Hodges stated that Bremer became greatly angered when he viewed a television program on the life of Martin Luther King. Hodges said he last saw Bremer the day following the primary when he asked to help in the Indiana primary, and Hodges turned him down. Bremer may have infiltrated the Wallace campaign in order to get a shot at the candidate, a possibility enhanced by an incident that took place on primary day, April 4th. Wallace was staying at the Midtown Holiday Inn, some two blocks from Bremer's apartment. A policeman sitting in a patrol car in the vicinity of the hotel later identified Bremer as the young man who approached him and pointed a finger at him in simulation of a gun. The policeman rebuked him, saying he could get shot fooling like that. Bremer asked about the security for Wallace, and when told that it was tight, switched the topic to how they didn't build cars like they used to, before ambling away. Two Wallace campaign lieutenants asserted that they saw Bremer at the celebration on primary night. With his striking blonde hair and his blank-eating grin, in the words of one policeman I interviewed, Bremer stood out in a crowd. But the Wallace aide's account, as well as the policeman's story and Gray Hodges' contention that he saw Bremer the next day, conflicts with the putative Bremer diary. The first entry in the diary is dated the morning of the Wisconsin primary. It mentions nothing about an encounter with a policeman, but talks about hurriedly catching a plane for New York City at 2:40 in the afternoon. Press reports have verified that Bremer was registered at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York on April 7th and 8th, leaving his whereabouts for April 4th and 6th undocumented. Were the sightings of Bremer in Milwaukee in error, or was the diary fictionalized? Bremer flew back from New York in time to catch the 8:15 p.m. car ferry from Milwaukee to Ludington, Michigan, on Sunday, April 9th. As the diary puts it, he was off to, quote, meet Nixon in Ottawa by the 13th. Frustrated by the tight security, he then switched his sights to Wallace, or so the diary says. Inexplicably, however, he drove south. He was stopped by a traffic officer in New York State to the vicinity of Washington, D.C., where he spent a couple of aimless days before returning to Milwaukee.
Continuing with the shooting of George Wallace by William W. Turner. Skipping again a short section of the essay. Bremer's known income was badly out of kilter with his expenditures for the period. In round numbers, he spent some $1,000 for rent, $795 for a 1967 Rambler, and $275 for three guns, a total of $2,070 for these three items alone. He owned a tape recorder, portable radio and police band, binoculars and other equipment. Adding the cost of food, sundries, gasoline, repairs, air and ferry fares, hotel and motel accommodations, and such miscellaneous outlays as $48 in a New York massage parlor, he offered the masseuse $100 to turn a trick in his Waldorf Astoria room, one arrives at a conservative figure of $4,200 spent. Considering that Bremer lost money in the failed button business, that his mother withheld part of his income, and that his mother withheld part of his income, it appears that he received at least $1,500 and perhaps substantially more from a mysterious source. The Milwaukee police checked on the possibility that he committed a robbery or burglary, but found no indication of it, thereby obviously leaving the question of where did he get this particular money. And, oh, next, we skip another section and continuing with the last few pages of the shooting of George Wallace by William Turner. Although identified as a loner, Bremer was not without companions. Jerry Stone, a mechanic in the service station where Bremer frequently brought his car for repairs, described a close buddy, unquote, who was about 24, slight of build with a ponytail hairdo and scraggly in appearance. Twice, Bremer and the buddy came in with a girl, dressed hippie but clean, unquote, who seemed to be Bremer's girlfriend. On several occasions, Bremer drove up in a 1966 green Chevrolet van with Illinois license plates, plastered with red, white, and blue Jesus Saves stickers. With him were a half dozen or so hippie types yelling and singing. Apparently, Bremer was involved with an element of the Jesus Freaks, unquote, a counterculture spinoff that had turned to fundamentalist religion and right-wing politics and was flourishing in the Milwaukee area in the early 1970s. Jerry Stone vividly recalled that he once accidentally smashed a finger with a tool and cried out, "God, come down from heaven and I'll punch you." Bremer angrily remonstrated, "Don't ever say that," unquote. Bremer's last appearance at the service station occurred about 3 weeks before the shooting. He announced that he was going on a trip. His ponytailed buddy continued to patronize it, but disappeared after the shooting. In the weeks leading up to the shooting, Bremer stalked Wallace during campaign appearances in Michigan. The ferry records reflected that he crossed from Michigan to Milwaukee on the evening of April 28th. He could have driven to Michigan by the long route around the lake, and took an early morning ferry to Michigan on May 9th. The next day, the conspicuous Bremer was seen several times in Cadillac, Michigan, and at a Wallace rally that evening sat with a neatly dressed man of about 40. Newsmen familiar with Cadillac said that they did not recognize the man, unquote. On May 12th and 13th, he was in Kalamazoo for more Wallace rallies and was questioned by a policeman after parking for several hours across from a rally location. From Michigan, Bremer headed for Maryland, whose primary was also on May 16th, and where Wallace was now stumping for last-minute votes. The former busboy tried to obtain a room at the Sheraton Motor Inn in New Carrollton, where he had stayed on a previous visit to the Washington area, but the place was full. He was spotted as early as 2:15 p.m. on May 15th at the Laurel Shopping Plaza, where the Alabama governor was scheduled later. At 4 p.m. that day, Wallace was shot. Although the FBI insisted there was no conspiracy, George Wallace remains unconvinced that Bremer acted alone. The possibility that he was a pawn must be considered. There are many unanswered questions. Like the August 1973 suicide of Republican Congressman William O. Mills of Maryland. Although his death coincided with the unfolding scandal involving Spiro Agnew, the rumor persists that Mills had money in his war chest that came from Nixon's 1968 surplus, and that an aide paid Bremer a total of $15,000 to spy on Wallace. There is also the fact that Nixon dirty trickster Donald Segretti was active in Wisconsin. A former state chairman of the College Republicans, J. Timothy Gratz, G-R-A-T-Z, disclosed that Segretti met with him in Madison and urged him to recruit persons to perform mischief against Democratic candidates. Segretti's machinations were so suspicious, Gratz said, that he got in touch with CREEP headquarters in Washington. CREEP decided to dispatch two representatives to Wisconsin to check on Segretti, one of whom was Anthony T. Ulasewicz, the former New York Red Squad policeman whom CREEP had sent to Massachusetts to try to dig up dirt on Ted Kennedy. Segretti reportedly denied to the Senate Watergate Committee that he had contacts with Bremer during the Wisconsin primary.
Continuing. In a coincidence too timely to ignore, Arthur Bremer's older brother William was implicated in a $36,000 Florida swindle in March 1972 and was represented by attorney Ellis Rubin, who would also represent the Miami Four involved in the Watergate break-in 3 months later. In an interview, Rubin scoffed at any link and quoted William Bremer as saying he hadn't seen his brother since Arthur was 4 years old. Another loose end is the role of a shadowy outfit called Transcontinental International Press Service. An acronym is TIPS. According to the landlady at Bremer's apartment, the first press representative to show up after the shooting was from TIPS, T-I-P-S. When it belatedly searched the apartment, the FBI was said to have found evidence that the suspect was, quote, allied with left-wing causes, including a Black Panthers publication. The question naturally arose, did the man from T-I-P-S plant the evidence? TIPS, or T-I-P-S, had all the earmarks of being a cover of some kind. It first came to the attention of the conventional press when two of its, quote, correspondents were challenged during the Pentagon Papers trial on April 17, 1972, a day on which Samuel Adams of the CIA was testifying. The TIPS people actually carried Los Angeles police press passes, although no one had ever heard of the organization before. On August 1st of that year, TIPS returned its passes to the police, saying it was going out of business. Police press officer Dan Cook remarked that this was the first time passes were ever sent back. Was there any connection between the reported appearance of TIPS at Bremer's apartment and Charles Colson's instruction to E. Howard Hunt to fly to Milwaukee? It would be interesting to listen to the White House tapes of May 15, 1972, to determine if they might help resolve the riddle. Finally, there is the question mark concerning the ballistics evidence. At Bremer's trial in state court, FBI laboratory expert Robert A. Frazier testified that he could not match the bullets recovered from Wallace and the other victims to the revolver snatched from Bremer. The bullets could have been fired from any one of thousands of similar weapons, he said. In addition, the paraffin casts taken of Bremer's hands were negative, suggesting that there might have been the same kind of second gun backup that has become an issue in the Robert Kennedy assassination. When he was sentenced on August 4, 1972, Bremer was given the chance to make a statement. Quote, "I think what I have to say would run longer than the transcript of this trial," he declared enigmatically, "so I won't say anything at this time."
Well, there are obviously a lot of questions raised concerning the circumstances around the shooting of George Wallace. That last couple of details, the fact that the paraffin tests on Bremer's hands were negative, would indicate the minor detail that Arthur Bremer had not fired a gun, which would raise serious, serious questions about whether or not he could have shot George Wallace. If he didn't fire a gun, he must have been a rather remarkable fellow to have pumped four bullets into George Wallace. That must have been Joe Isuzu and fired him with his teeth or something like that. At any rate, the connections between Wallace's, the fact that Wallace, had been following the Wallace campaign for quite some time, the mysterious sources of funding, because apparently he overspent his income, and the fact that the Nixon campaign, the Committee to Reelect the President, was very interested in the circumstances surrounding Arthur Bremer's apartment raised some questions. Again, the Trans-Intercontinental Press Service, which had obtained Los Angeles police press passes, is an interesting situation in and of itself. As William W. Turner asks in that essay, were the Nixon White House people, were the E. Howard Hunt proxies there to remove damaging information leading in the direction of creep, to plant damaging information, lead to false information leading in the direction of the left, or both? It's also interesting, too, that Arthur Bremer's background involves, among other things, Jesus freaks, too, because his sister, Gail Aiken, was the secretary for the brother of the Reverend Jerry Owen, one of the principal figures in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, who we looked at in RFA number 9. The Reverend Jerry Owen was a right-wing minister hooked up with Aryan Nations elements, specifically groups hooked stemming from Wesley Swift and the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which metamorphosed into the Richard Butler Aryan Nations group, etc. And a lot of interesting questions surrounding the shooting of George Wallace. Also interesting that one of the hypnotists who may have been involved in hypno-programming, Saran Saran, also reportedly received a call from Laurel, Maryland, right around the time of the George Wallace shooting. This was a guy named William J. Bryan, Jr., and we looked at that and the Gail Aiken connection in RFA number 9. Also interesting, of course, that there are many other links between Richard Nixon and or people around him and other assassinations. The fact that the Saran family's entrance into the United States was sponsored by political allies and friends of Richard Nixon. The fact that James Golden, who headed up Nixon's security in 1968, was on leave from Lockheed. The Thane Caesar, who may well have been the person who shot Robert Kennedy, was working not only out of Lockheed's Burbank facility at a U-2 section controlled by the CIA, but was moonlighting as a security guard at the time when he may have shot Robert Kennedy. Of course, Nixon was in Dallas on November 22, 63. 4 months later, when interviewed by the FBI, his memory was off by 48 hours. He said he left on November 20th. And there are a lot of other interesting connections. So, again, the fact that Dan Carter may not have been able to uncover a lot of information concerning the Nixon White House and its interest in the possibility of a third-party candidacy by George Wallace in 1972 is worth mulling over in light of the curious questions surrounding the assassination attempt on George Wallace.
And also, just again to make this point, we have to stop and look at these things in a less linear way sometimes. I think what's really fascinating about these cases is that we're being asked time and time again to believe these incredible series of coincidences. We talked, of course, at length, and Dave just reviewed a lot of the information recently about the Hinckley family and their multitudinous connections to George Bush and the
Nazis, and World Vision, and CIA.
The CIA.